tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go. Hey there, listeners. This is Kristen. I'm the technical tabby over here at the Community Cats Podcast, and I just wanted to pop in. If you caught last week's episode, you know we've been checking out From the Backyard to the Front Page, Building a TNR Movement. It's a special two-part series recorded live during a Neighborhood Cats webinar. In part one, we follow Brian Cortis through the early days of grassroots TNR in New York City and learn how one small colony sparked a great big movement. Today, in part two, we're going to roll up our sleeves and we're going to get into some nitty-gritty details. From setting up trap banks to coaching new volunteers to working with local governments and adapting to both urban and rural communities, this episode is packed with tried-and-true tactics for building a sustainable, scalable TNR program. Whether you're just getting started or you're looking to level up, there is a ton of practical wisdom here. So let's get into it and see what it really takes to keep a TNR movement growing strong. As your regular host and head cat here at the podcast, Stacey LeBaron, always says, thanks for listening and thanks for turning your passion for cats into action. Enjoy the show.
This is kind of a depiction of the type of program that we developed in New York City, which was, again, a small group dealing with a lot of need. So we developed what I call a network of services, and they encompassed the field work involved in trap neuter return. So making traps available to people, helping with transport in a city where a lot of people don't have cars, providing expert assistance in the field, and as well as training, and also holding space. Sometimes people did not have anywhere to put their cats. So that expert assistance goes, training should be in there too. On the veterinary side, you want to facilitate low-cost surgeries. As your program develops, what we're finding a lot in New York City now is when these guys, it used to be that feral cats, the researchers estimated their average lifespan to be just 2 or 3 years. We have a lot of older community cats now, and they end up needing dentals and extra veterinary care. So if you obviously can't help every situation, but if you're able to provide support, usually financial, at least some cases, it can go a long way towards supporting the community. And then caretaking, of course, is kind of the long-term work of trap neuter return. And the way our organization tries to support that is we do food drives and then distribute the donations. We do winter shelter distributions every year, where we contract with local manufacturers and then sell the shelters either at or below our cost. And then, of course, online groups, discussion groups, Facebook groups, where caretakers can network among each other, and that which is a great thing because people can often solve problems and then not have to turn to us to help them. So I mentioned how we use workshops as the entry point to this, and this is kind of the ideal flow of the grassroots program that we have. So obviously step number one is just outreach. It's just getting the word out that you have resources, that you have training, that there is a network of services available. So that could be whatever works best in your community. It might be social media. It might be, we had signs in malls, newspapers, whatever works best to get the word out, email. So people hear about us, they contact our program. And for people who are physically able then to do the work of TNR, we encourage them to attend our training. Now, once people have attended a workshop, then, for example, for folks in New York City, one of our handouts is an extensive guide to all the resources that are available that they can now access. And it includes a list of veterinarians. So ideally, the caretakers, the people who are doing the TNR, they're going to schedule the spay neuter directly. They're going to arrange to pick up traps from our trap bank, and they go through they do the trapping themselves, bring the cats to spay neuter, and do the recovery, and then, of course, at the end, do the release. So our ideal TNR person is somebody where they go to the training and then maybe with a little bit of support from us, but they mostly go through the TNR process themselves. So when you're doing a grassroots program like this, Ironically, the goal is to do as little as possible, not as much, because you want to spread your resources as broadly as possible. So you don't want to get bogged down in too many projects that require you to do almost everything. It's much better if you can guide people through the process and they do most of it themselves. Now, that's not to say that's going to always be the case, but so like I said, so the certification is the gateway to all these resources that are available to people. And you want to, within your community, either share the certification list with other providers, or what we do with the Community Cats podcast is a certificate is issued that you can, that can then be shown, and we can verify it if somebody asks that the certificate was issued. Trap banks are really a necessity for a TNR program that's working with the public in a big way, because like my idea of a successful trap neuter return program on that kind of urban suburban scale is when you have people doing TNR who really are not animal welfare people, but they see a situation, they want to help the cats, they understand TNR is the best way to do it, and they want to go do that situation, and that's it. They may never come into contact with the animal welfare community or system again, but they will do the TNR for their, maybe they moved into a house and there's five cats in the backyard, or they've got a job and they're feeding several cats at the warehouse, and they want to do what's best for those guys, and that's it. They're not going to go out and buy six traps at $110 each for a one-time project. So you have to be able to supply that equipment for them, or the whole thing's a non-starter. So within your trap bank, you want to have what we call box traps, the regular long rectangular traps. You want drop traps as well, trap dividers, den, feral cat dens, cages. These are all good equipment to have. Although, of course, your number one priority is going to be box traps and trap dividers. Part of the training for people that we do in the certification workshops is show them how to take care of the cats in the traps and never to release them until they're either knocked out and going into surgery or they're going back home. So you need dividers to be able to do that. A good rule of thumb, if you're trying to figure out, well, how many traps do I need? Does our organization need? Twice as many as your weekly spay neuter capacity is a good rule of thumb, because that way, let's say you can do 50 cats a week. Then it's good to have 100 traps, because during the week, so you send 50 traps out, people are catching their cats. Well, they're going to be held in the traps. They're going to go to surgery. They're going to be held afterwards. They have to be cleaned. They have to be returned. You don't want to be hoping that all 50 of those cats come back in time to start the next week's quota. You want to have 50 cats and traps in reserve that just go right out. And that way, there's no interruptions in the flow. As far as how to manage a trap bank, we've had a lot of success. It's really up to you. There's no one right or wrong way to do it. There's just trade-offs. So having appointments is very convenient for the people who are picking up and dropping off, but might not be so convenient for your organization when people are late or they don't show up or they need to reschedule. We've had a lot of success with just saying, all right, Saturday from 10 a.m. to noon, the trap bank's open. That's when you pick up. That's when you drop off. We did that for a long time, and it worked quite well. We do have trap bank managers now who actually don't mind doing appointments, so we do a mixture of both. But find what works best for your organization. Trapping support is something that we've been able to grow over time as you develop more and more experienced people who have trapping, who've done trapping, and you have people who want to volunteer and help out your program. This is a great way to get volunteers. We actually offer stipends to help people cover their gas and other expenses. We call them TNR coaches, and they're generally present on the first day of a trapping, if somebody's doing a mass trapping for their entire colony, because we found that's the most important day. If you've got 10 cats, probably going to catch, if you do it right, you're going to catch 8 or 9 of them on day one. So it's great to have somebody there who has hands-on experience and then can be there when the cats are being cared for in the traps, and you end up with infield training. So think about doing that with your volunteer. They can also be somebody that the caretaker or the new trapper can call up for advice throughout the project. So we found that people really like having that support when they're brand new to this. And then, of course, holding space. That's where 2 or 3 days before surgery, trapped cats are going to be held. We generally encourage people not to wait until the day before to trap, because if you get bad weather or all of a sudden there's a construction project next door you didn't know about, you're going to end up with a lot of empty spots. So we encourage people to always start 2 days. Like if your spay-neuter day is on Monday, then and you're going after a lot of cats, start on Saturday. Don't wait till Sunday. So any space that's warm, dry, and secure, meaning warm, because the cats come out of surgery, they're under anesthesia, they can't regulate their body temperature. So they need to be put in a space that's at least 65 degrees Fahrenheit, needs to be protected from the weather, and it needs to be so that only people involved in the project have access to the space, so secure in that way. As I said, especially in New York City, where people live in apartments, a lot of people do, they don't have holding space. So we decided against having a central holding space for a number of reasons, but mostly because we felt like, well, that's, however, it's going to be full all the time. There'll be a, then you have to deal with, well, what people don't pick up their cats, and what about liability, and what about egress and entrance? And we just decided it was too much for us to manage. But we do have volunteers throughout the city who maybe for $5 a day or for free, they'll lend their basement or their garage to as a holding space. So we help connect people with those resources. And again, we're filling in the gaps and trying to get these projects done. Spay neuter as part of your network of services. Just a good rule of thumb is the lower the cost, the higher the participation you'll have in your program. So that's not to say you shouldn't have a program. If you don't have $50 spay-neuter, but let's say it's $125, it just means you won't have as many people participating because they can't afford it or you can't fund it. But you should still go ahead and always with trap-neuter return. Like I said in the video, we're not trying to be perfect. We're trying to improve things. And if you're moving in a targeted way and getting high sterilization rates within colonies, then whatever work you do is a plus, is a benefit. But keep in mind that the closer you get to free, the more people are going to participate. Another thing to keep in mind with your spay-neuter is to the extent that you can, you want to schedule by the colony, not by the caretaker. And that goes back to our colony level targeting that we talked about earlier. So the tendency of a lot of spay-neuter clinics or programs who have access to spay-neuter is, all right, I've got 10 people asking for help. I've got 50 spots. I'm going to give everybody 5. That is not effective targeting. You're much better off finding out from those 10 caretakers who among them adds up to 50 cats in their colonies and just schedule those colonies and get them as close to 100% spayed and neutered as you can and take care of the other colonies at the next clinic. If you spread your spay and neuter surgeries out too thinly, you'll never get ahead of the reproductive curve. Good rule also is at clinics is that any cat that's coming in for a TNR rate, which is a discounted rate, or maybe the whole clinic is supposed to be just TNR, the cats must be ear tipped. If somebody's really adamant and doesn't want their cat tipped, then refer them to another clinic that deals with pet cats. You're not going to eliminate fraud, frankly, people pretending their cats are outdoors when they're not, but you'll significantly cut down on it if you insist on ear tipping. Plus, if there's any chance these cats are going outside, they really need to be ear tipped for your program to be able to function. You have to be able to tell from a distance what cats are fixed and what are not. The rule at the clinic should always be that one cat per trap, and the trap is covered. Cats should in carriers should probably be turned away because it's dangerous and people need to learn that, no, that's not acceptable to bring a potentially feral cat that the staff then has to pull out of carrier and there's risk of injury and escape. Experienced clinics will turn you away if you don't bring the cat in the trap. Keep in mind, if you're working with veterinarians who are new to TNR and new to community cats, you may know more than they do about how to handle ferals and show them. Show them how to keep the, I mean, I just remember our early days when we would bring a cat in a trap to a veterinarian and they would struggle and transfer the cat into like a steel bank cage. And they sometimes not get the door closed in time. And I'd just stand there going like, how are you going to get this cat out? Right? You don't need to go through that. That's where you can find out how high a feral cat can jump in terms of them getting into the ceiling. So keep them in the traps, show them how to use trap dividers and to how to feed and clean in the trap. And you may find that veterinarians all of a sudden they're much more comfortable with working with feral cats if they understand that they never actually have to touch them or handle them unless they're under anesthesia. I mentioned before maintaining an active caretaker network. So food, shelter, straw distributions in cold climates during the winter, online groups. I know in New York City, like every borough's got at least one Facebook group. There's the Brooklyn group and the Queens group. And even within Brooklyn, there are subgroups. And that's real important because, again, yeah, I saw somebody in the comments had said straw, not hay. A very important point to make. People, for, I don't know why, maybe we're brought up that way, but everybody confuses straw and hay. Straw is dried. It's dry and it's brittle. And cats can burrow into it. Hay is food for animals. It's moist. And if you use hay instead of straw, it's going to get moldy and can cause all kinds of health problems. So make sure you get straw. One of the things you want to be doing with your program is anybody who touches it, you want to be collecting their name and their email address, preferably their snail mail address as well, but especially their email. And then join MailChimp or Constant Contact. MailChimp, you can get a free account, I believe, for under 2,000 names. So every time there's a new resource available, you can let everybody know via the email network. But also, if you have a caretaker who needs to relocate a cat or who needs somebody to feed over the weekend that they're gone, you, as your program, you can send out a request for assistance to your network and often get those needs filled. And again, you strengthen the connection between people who are doing this work. This is a tough one for a lot of people, but in the beginning, when you're trying to build your movement, again, it's always important to be strategic. So we generally looked at people who wanted our help in three different categories. One is people who were willing to do the work, the hands-on TNR work, and able to do it. That's your number one audience when you're starting out, is the people who want to do it. And they're just looking for, how do I do it? And a little bit of guidance on where are the resources. But you give them a little push and they're on their way. That's what your movement is going to grow from. Our very first TNR certification workshop in New York City, there were 12 people who attended, and five of them went on to start their own nonprofit TNR groups. And it made us realize that these were the people who already were motivated, and they just needed to be pointed in the right direction, and they were going to go out and spread their own grassroots. And that's really important. If that first workshop had been 12 people who could do nothing themselves and needed us to do all the work for them, that would have been great for them and for the cats they were taking care of, but it would not have helped us grow TNR as a movement in New York City. So that's your target audience. Now, as your program matures, you can start to deal with category number two, which is people who really are willing to do the work, but they're not able to. And that could be because they have special needs. There may be a physical disability. They may be at a point in their life where they're just not able to lift up a trap with a 10-pound cat. Maybe they can't drive, whatever it may be. They're worthy people to help, but they need a lot of support. So you have to be realistic about how much of that your program can handle. So like I say, you can't in the beginning be doing only that. As your program grows and you get more funds and you have more volunteers, you'll find that you can help more and more people in this category. Now, the last category is people who are able to do the work, but they're not willing. And that doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means they just don't want to do it for whatever reason. Maybe they're too busy or it's just not a high enough priority. They're happy to have someone else come and do it, but they don't want to take the time themselves. Now, those are the people that in the beginning you're not going to help. And that's hard for a lot of people in our field because behind every person that you're not helping are cats you're not helping. And they're innocent. Why should the ability for them to receive assistance depend on the quality or the attitude or the availability of their caretakers? And that's true, but there's only so many cats you can help. And one of the points I just keep hitting today is to be strategic, that to understand that every time you allocate your resources, which includes your time, your volunteers, your funds, you're making a choice. And you want those choices to be as smart and strategic as possible, because then your program will grow. And today in New York City, we help a lot of people in that second category, and even occasionally some in the third, because we've grown to the point where we can manage that. But if we hadn't been smart about our choices in the beginning, we never would have reached this point. With that third category, we found that sometimes we were able to help them because we just said, hey, look, if you could do it, but you want us to, fine, but you know, it's going to be $100 a cat. And they'd say, sure. And we would make sure all our expenses plus a little more was paid to us. And we'd go do the TNR ourselves. And sometimes we actually got some great donors from doing that. So that's one alternative if you want to. And that can help your network grow, of course, if you're bringing in more money as a kind of paid service. So I've mentioned in-field training. So this is for those of you who are like, well, this is all very good, but you know, I live in a small town, or we try to do certification workshops in a city, like a suburb, and like not enough people came for it to make a difference. So we realized that's not a way that's going to work for this particular community. So what you can do is in-field training. And that's where somebody's willing to trap. They're not willing to come and take 2 or 3 hours to learn how. So you're going to go bring the traps to them and you're going to show them how to use them and how to cover them up and to call your program when the cats are trapped, if they don't know how to take care of them themselves. And if you're dealing with a rural or sometimes even a suburban population, that might have to be your approach because you can't get them to come to workshops and you don't have it's not New York City where you have millions of people as a potential pool. You've only got thousands and maybe you're not going to get enough people. And in these smaller areas, this kind of grassroots movement approach may have to be more what I call an expert approach, where you try to get people to do as much as you can get them to do, but there's a lot more gaps to fill if you're going to get enough cats fixed. So you have to be realistic about what your community will tolerate in terms of training and participating hands-on. And you may have to rely more on, yeah, we do the trapping, we do the transporting. And again, but the theory is the same, which is still try to get people to contribute funds or to contribute their time or to watch the traps or to let you use their garage for the holding space, whatever resources you can get out of the people that you're helping, the better.
Kittens may be small, but caring for them takes big knowledge. And the Online Kitten Conference is here to help. Join us on June 7th and 8th for 2 full days of expert-led sessions focused entirely on kitten care, fostering, and program management. From bottle feeding to behavior, this conference covers it all. It's a fully virtual event, so you can tune in from anywhere. And registration includes access to the recordings, slides, and handouts. You'll hear from experienced professionals, get access to valuable resources, and connect with a community that shares your passion for saving lives. Learn more and register at communitycatspodcast.com/kittens, because the tiniest lives deserve the best care. Are you getting your message across to your entire community? Do they know what programs you offer and what they can do to help? Learn more about how to effectively market your organization or just sharpen your skills with a free self-paced marketing course, The Fundamentals of Marketing on Maddie's University. The course is designed to provide a basic understanding of marketing and provide you with templates and tools to elevate and improve your organization's brand, voice, and audience, and have fun while doing it.
You'll receive a strategic marketing plan template to download free. Go to university.maddiesfund.org and search marketing to enroll now. In a recent study, 97% of respondents said that pets are family. Communities can play a vital role in helping to keep families together. Whether it's reuniting lost pets with their owners, donating pet supplies or funds for pet owners in need, or offering short or long-term fostering, people can help keep pets and their people together. We just have to show them how. Did you know there are resources you can use to help bring attention to the programs you offer to help them do just that? From public service announcements, short videos, printable posters, online and social graphics, and much more. Find your resources at www.petsandpeopletogether.org/campaign-resources. Hashtag be a helper.
So I want to spend the last bit of time before we take questions on another aspect of all this, which is, what about if you're in a community where you're facing legal obstacles and you can't even get started, or you can't get started in a significant way unless you have municipal support? So this can be a whole presentation. In fact, I've done an hour on this, but I want to distill like the main points for you today on how to approach what I call persuading municipal officials. And the basic idea is, you're making presentations, right? You're talking to people. Maybe you're speaking at a city council meeting, or you're meeting with the mayor, or you're talking to the shelter director. This is the three steps you want to break your presentation into. So the number one step is, what is the government's interest in free roaming cats? Like, why should they be interested in TNR? Why should they care about this? And you need to be very specific when you talk to them about why it is in their interest, not yours, but theirs, to deal with this situation. Once you've identified that, you want to talk about, well, what are the alternatives besides TNR, and why don't they work? And once you've done that, your last step is to introduce TNR, explain what it is, why it can work, and provide some examples of success. So let's break that down just a little bit. So what are your municipal interests in free roaming and community cat? Well, there's a number of them, potentially. There's animal sheltering and control. So they're going to be interested in intake, because the more cats come in, the higher their costs, the more staff is needed. Euthanasia, generally, that's something that communities want to have as low as possible. There's also costs involved in that. Complaints. Animal control may love to have the number of cat-related complaint calls coming in so they could spend their time on what they consider more pressing issues. Public health, if you have rabies in the area, then free roaming cats are going to be a big issue. As I explained before, there's going to be sanitation, noise, odor complaints that come into the health department. Wildlife, if there are endangered species in your areas and there's a risk of predation, or sometimes cats compete with the endangered species for food sources, like there's certain kinds of endangered cranes that eat mice. And if the cats eat the mice too, that's harmful to the birds. So having fewer cats can help promote wildlife conservation. And then there's animal welfare. And that is why you're doing this. But it's important to understand that it's usually the least important interest for the municipality. And that's a big mistake a lot of us make as advocates, is we expect government officials to care about the cats as much as we do. And frankly, they don't. And to be totally honest, that's not their job. Their job is to look out for their residents, and they're going to put human interests ahead of animal interests every single time. So if you go into a meeting with the mayor and your first thing is that TNR is going to be so great for the cats and alleviate their suffering and things like that, you're going to lose them, right? You got to go in there talking about how you're going to save them money because there's fewer cats coming into the shelter, or how there's going to be fewer rabies exposures when the cats are all vaccinated. And I still would mention animal welfare, because there's usually someone on the city council who's got a cat or who actually knows about animal welfare and cares about that. So you want to touch on it, but you don't want to make that the focus of your pitch. So step one, which is identifying interests. Why is that step one? Because if you are realistic about potential problems of community cats having to do with overwhelming the shelter with kittens every spring, or nuisance complaints, rabies, potential rabies exposures. You may feel like, gee, I'm arguing against the cats, not for them. But actually what you're doing is you're being honest and you're being realistic and you're showing the government why they should care about this. You're also establishing your credibility because they know these are the issues. And you're not trying to whitewash them. You're trying to be out front. And the other main thing, besides establishing credibility and demonstrating why the government should care about this, is it allows you, by acknowledging the problems, potential negative impacts of community cats, it allows you to move the discussion to what are you going to do about it, right? And that's what your government officials and shelter directors, that's what they really care about. They know there are problems. You're agreeing. And now we can, instead of arguing about whether they're a problem or not, you can discuss what are you going to do about it. That's when you get to step two, when I recommend you talk about everything you could do besides TNR. And the reason you do that is because none of this ever works. So you could do nothing and just let the situation continue to fester. You could try to remove them, usually for euthanasia, but for all sorts of reasons I won't go into here, but it's basic policy stuff. Removing cats does not work. If it did, we wouldn't be here today talking about the problem. They would have solved it a long time ago. Feeding bans don't work because basically nobody listens to them and they're unenforceable. And different laws like licensing at large, pet limits, again, we have historical failures that are extremely low compliance and very difficult to enforce. So at this point, hopefully your government official is in a complete state of despair because you've talked about all the problems and how nothing works to solve them. And that's when you come to the rescue with TNR and start to talk about its advantages. Like if they're spayed neutered, they can't reproduce. That's your best chance for the population to decline. It dramatically reduces nuisance behavior. Now, I'll give you a tip as an advocate for many years on TNR. That's what most government officials care about the most. Interestingly, they're not as worried about how many cats there are if they're not causing them problems, if they're not getting complaint calls. And spayed and neutered cats result in far fewer complaints to the municipality. So that's often the point that I'll emphasize the most, is the reduction of nuisance behavior. Of course, rabies transmissions cut off, less predation if there's fewer cats. Also, TNR has the support of the public and the feeders and the caretakers. And again, that last point, which is nothing else works. So what have you got to lose? Now, you're going to have people who are opposed to track neuter return in your community for whatever reason. They say it's bad for the cats or it's bad for wildlife. That's usually what comes up. We shouldn't have cats on the streets at all, et cetera, and so forth. Now, the trick here as an advocate, what you need to know is that your opponent is not going to want you to get to steps two or three. They're going to want to stay on step one, which is describing the problems. And the reason for that is because when you get to step two and three, your opponent really doesn't have much to offer, since everything they have to offer has been tried and failed. If you read a paper by a conservationist that's against trap neuter return, and it's 20 paragraphs long, the first 19 paragraphs are going to be about how horrible feral cats are, and they spread toxoplasmosis, and they kill wildlife, and they cause all sorts of nuisances, and they'll list the 18 possible zoonotic diseases that a cat can spread. And you're thinking like, I'm reading these articles, and I'm thinking like, so what are you going to do about it? And then they never get to that. Or if they get to it, they get to like the last paragraph and they suggest something completely off the wall, like, well, they should all be eradicated. Or there was one article that said like, we should find empty lots in suburban areas and put the cats in there because they knew people wouldn't go for euthanasia and eradication. And it's just really silly stuff. So they don't want to talk about solutions because they don't have any, but they don't want you to talk about solutions either. So they'll try to drag the debate into the horrors of free-roaming cats. And if you start your presentation and your discussion by acknowledging there are issues and then saying, let's talk about what we're going to do about it, you're in a much better chance to win that debate. If you've got like and I've seen this at city council meetings where you've got 20 minutes to talk about why TNR should be accepted, and your opponent has 20 minutes to talk about why it shouldn't, right? Now, if you look at the totality of time spent talking about it, because you don't have all day, and you spend most of your time talking about do cats kill birds, and they're not a native species, and how about disease, and shelters are overrun, and there's lots of cruelty to cats, and you spend all your time debating about how much of a problem these things are, and whether they really are a problem or not. And then you look back out of the 40 minutes total, you spent 30 minutes talking about problems and only 10 minutes talking about solutions, you're probably going to lose that debate. But on the other hand, if you acknowledge that free roaming cats can adversely impact these interests, there's nothing to argue about here. We agree they could spread disease, they could kill birds, they can be a nuisance. We agree on that. So let's talk about what we're going to do about it. And you spend all your time explaining why certain methods don't work and why TNR can, and why don't we do a pilot project. That's your best chance of winning. So a couple of quick tips on this advocacy stuff. Use data. You want to be able to make the argument that whatever you're doing now isn't working. And you need to show that with hard facts. So look at the intake into the shelter. If it's going up or it's not going down, that's a failed policy. Same with complaint calls. I mean, a successful approach is going to see these things going down. What's the cost of the municipality? Are they paying? Do they have their own shelter, in which case they can calculate the cost per cat that's euthanized? Are they paying a local shelter by the cat? If so, you can actually calculate how much money is being spent every year on basically removing and euthanizing cats, which is a method that doesn't solve anything because the same level of complaints are coming in every year. Pilot projects, don't pull it out of the deck right away, but if you sense hesitancy on the decision maker's part, then maybe you want to step in and say, well, let's just try a pilot project, right? Low risk. If it doesn't go well, then you're not committed to anything. And again, make sure that the pilot project is stacked in your favor. And then finally, I want to go back to that point I made before, which is don't make this an emotional thing. Don't plead for the kitties, right? You're not a cat lover. I mean, you are, but don't present yourself as a cat lover. You're a cat population control expert, right? It's very cut and dry. That's what government officials like. They don't want the emotional stuff about how much you love cats and how good this will be and how hard it is for them now. They want to know that their interests are going to be addressed and their problems solved. So dress professionally, whatever the standard of your audience is. If they usually wear business attire, you wear business attire. And like I say, leave the sweater with the paw prints at home. I see that a lot at government presentations. And I mean, some people in the audience, you might have them kind of doing the cat with the paw print stuff. But if you're the presenter, if you're the spokesman for the group, you want to be as professional as possible. Okay, just other quick things, just to let you guys know, if you're doing this work, you're not alone. Recommend you join the Community Cats podcast Facebook group. And then, of course, there's lots of other social media, both on Neighborhood Cats and the Community Cats podcast.
Hello.
Here we go.
I have a ton of questions here. Somebody who lives in Georgia has been dealing with their ornithological society, who supports feeding bans and euthanasia for community cats. They've tried to address things with them, but they would like a little more information on how you approach these groups that are not just thinking that the cats are a problem, but are organized and are really working against TNR and the efforts that you're making?
Well, there's two aspects to that. First, try to work together. Sometimes you get reasonable people on the conservation side, and you have to be reasonable too. So if you're advocating for trap, neuter, return for a colony of a dozen cats that live in the middle of a bird sanctuary, you're probably not going to succeed because they can have a potentially destructive impact, and you want to look at other potential live outcomes, relocation, that kind of a thing, especially if it's a small-scale situation. Now, let's say it's a large-scale situation. You're talking about 200 cats, and relocation is out of the question. That attempts have been made to remove the cats in the past and they haven't worked. And you're looking at trap, neuter, return as really the only practical way to address that situation. And the conservationists are still really adamantly against it. That's the point where you often go, why would you be against something that would help the birds when you have no other alternative? And there's this element of irrationality at times where they're so against trap, neuter, return that they can't suffer it ever being allowed. And at that point, you're like, all right, now my focus is shifting from cooperating with you to convincing the decision maker that you're wrong and I'm right, and we should try my way. And that's when you get into what I was talking about before. So the conservationists are going to spend all their time talking about how horrible the cats are, right? And that they cause all this disease and that they are killing all the birds and things like that. They're going to try to get you into an argument about how bad the cats are. And you can say things that are true, like it's the loss of habitat that's the real problem for endangered species, much more so than cats. And the spread of disease is often greatly exaggerated. But if you spend all your time on that, the decision maker is going to be like, I can't. They're probably going to go with the PhDs and the scientists, and you lose, and they don't do TNR. Instead, if you say, look, I don't want to argue about whether cats spread disease. I don't want to argue about how much of a threat they are to the birds. I want to talk about how do we get fewer cats? Because all of our problems are solved if we don't have as many cats. And you shift the discussion over to what are you going to do about it instead of what the problems are. Then you can get the decision makers on your side.
Excellent. I would also add, if you're okay with it, that it's important to identify the cats that are the problem. The TNR program is great if the cats are out in the wild causing the problems. It might be indoor-outdoor cats in a neighborhood nearby. It could be a situation like that. So it's worth maybe teaming up with the folks, because your goal is the same, that they don't want the cats there and you don't want the cats there either. So maybe get together and do some looking into what the legitimate problem is to make sure that the solutions you're suggesting are, in fact, going to solve the problem.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you always want to try to collaborate first, because I have dealt with very reasonable conservationists. And the foundation of that cooperation is when we both acknowledge that whether you're the animal welfare side or the conservation side, you want fewer cats on the landscape. Maybe for different reasons, but that the goal is the same. So if you focus on how do we achieve fewer cats, you have a much better chance of actually doing something productive as opposed to arguing about whether cats are a problem or not.
Definitely. All right. Let's shift a little bit and let's talk about recruitment. Somebody from steamy Miami have been working with you actually to set up CatSats Miami and now out to all of Broward County, which is very exciting. But they want to know how to target specific zip codes in the recruitment process, since the area is a large area that they're trying to work this movement in.
We go into outreach a lot in the targeted TNR webinar, so stay tuned for that. Just real briefly, when you're doing outreach, there's three different levels of outreach. There's sort of global, which is outreach that's going to include your target area and go beyond it. So that might be like a local TV spot or PSA. Or a radio show, or something, Facebook post that you just goes out everywhere.
A podcast,
that's good. And you're going to get a wave of people from your target area that way. You're also going to get people going like, how come you're not working here? So that's another thing. You have to have services for other people, not as much. But then your second wave is going to be more specific to that neighborhood, to that area. So when we worked on the Upper West Side, there was the West Side Spirit, which is a local paper that covered the West Side. You might put announcements on bulletin boards or local churches or things that only people in that area are most likely to see. And then when that runs out, you got to get your feet on the ground and you got to start going door to door, and you have to start talking to people, and you have to start making connections to caretakers. And that is going to be your greatest source of recruitment and finding out where the feeders and cats are.
Excellent. Two more quick questions, guys. They're coming in fast and furiously. Somebody is asking about approaching veterinarians who you want to work with you in your area to give you appointments. Are there specific questions you may want to ask when approaching veterinarians?
Well, I think that the number one question would be their level of spay-neuter experience. Don't be surprised with private veterinarians. They're not specialists in spay-neuter. So they'll do a few a month, whereas a specialist will do 20 in a day. So you want to assess the skill level because that's going to determine how long. Do you keep the cat for 24 hours after surgery or 72? And it depends a lot on the veterinarian's surgery experience. But whatever level of experience they have, they can do spay-neuter surgeries. So you want to work with them. And they may be hesitant to work with feral cats because they don't know how to handle them. So introduce them. Say, hey, by the way, if we bring a feral cat in, they're going to be in a trap and they're never going to leave the trap unless they've been sedated. And if you show them how that works, they may be a lot more comfortable with it. And then the other thing is just find out what can you comfortably accommodate. And if the answer is two cats a week, you take it. Whatever they can do, you take it because that relationship can grow. And once they become familiar with the cats and with you, and the positive impact of what they're doing, that may greatly expand. So those would be my tips for working with private vets.
Excellent. I also might refer folks to United Spay Alliance website, unitedspayalliance.org. And there is a listing on there by state of veterinarians who are familiar with high quality, high volume spay neuter. That might be a good place to start if you're looking to trim that list down right away. I think they're a great resource. Last question. It's a fun one. So because I love story time with Brian, Grandma, the cat that took 7 years to catch in New York City. There were all kinds of people asking, how did you eventually wind up catching her? What was your trick?
The drop trap.
Excellent.
That's how we eventually, she was such a tough cat to catch. We would do things like put the trap out in a very remote spot. We'd get like 200 feet away, peering down with binoculars. And one time we spread some catnip in front of the trap and try to lure her in. And she went right up to the under the door of the trap, started rolling around on the ground, and then got up and walked away. So she was really tough. But when we were introduced to the drop trap, we were like, all right, this will work. And it took 3 tries. So the first couple of tries, she sort of sat right next to it, looked in, and then decided, no. But the third time, once she was used to it, she just marched right in there and boom, we caught her. So
excellent. Credit.
And we have a webinar. We have a webinar on everything, but we have a webinar on how to use a drop trap that I really encourage people who aren't familiar with that to check that out. And even if you are, we spend half the webinar on advanced techniques, like how do you catch 6 or 7 cats at the same time? Things like that.
That is the most satisfying trap drop you will ever have. So I highly encourage you guys to learn how to use a drop trap.
We used 3 different drop traps at a site where the trick is that the cats do what we call cluster eating. And that means they all cluster around a big dish or a bowl. And that's when you know, like, wow, I can get all of them under a drop trap at the same time. And we had this one situation, we spread out 3 drop traps, put big plates of food in the middle, and we caught 13 at the same time.
Awesome. Wow. Goals, folks, goals. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Brian and Susie, for giving us this time with you to teach us all the things you learned the hard way starting out. And thank you to all the attendees for being here to learn. I know you guys are our future TNR leaders. So thank you for coming here and getting this information. So with that, we will let you guys go and we will see you soon. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Kristen.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.